Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your essential weekly guide to all the top stories and the hottest trends from the technology world. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we're going to discuss plans for an e-sports tournament which aims to put professional video games players in the same league as star footballers. And we'll talk about the AI arms race as tech giants compete to show they've got the smartest artificial intelligence scientists. Joining me is BBC technology reporter Jane Wakefield. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
And my special guest is Ben Skipper, video games reporter at IB Times UK. Welcome, Ben. You play video games for a living, is that right?
I do, yes, somehow.
And we'll talk about them at length later. Here's a flavour of what's in the show.
Our fans play with more frequency. They're engaged year-round, not just in a season. It's a global fan base. It's growing at a very rapid rate.
The heart of it is that the human is the hero, and we are creating AI technologies at Microsoft that amplify human ingenuity.
I think a lot of people believe that AI is going to be as big as electricity to economies, industries, businesses, and society.
All of that coming up in a fun-packed show. First, though, an incident in California which highlights the challenges facing sharing economy platforms when it comes to regulating their own users. An Airbnb host who made a racist comment to an Asian guest has been fined $5,000 and told she must attend a course on Asian American studies. But the action was taken due to an agreement between Airbnb and a local regulator. Our man in Silicon Valley, Dave Lee, is on the line and can explain all this. Dave, take it away.
Yes, it's a very interesting case. It's the first of its kind where the Californian Department of Fair Employment and Housing is basically now able to review instances on Airbnb where there's been perceived discrimination. And this is something that the company Airbnb has acknowledged as a problem. And there has been several pieces of research and lots of anecdotal evidence to show that people of certain races, particularly Black and Asian guests, find it more difficult to book rooms than other races. And so it's something the company's trying to get a hold on. And this case was brought to them, and they were able to investigate and take action. And the action, as you mentioned, $5,000 in fine. They also, the host must also take a course in Asian American studies and also do some community service with a civil rights group. So a very interesting a punishment there, I guess you could say. But I spoke to Kevin Kish, who's the director of the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. He said that the contrition shown by the host meant they could get creative. And here's what he had to say about it.
The idea of the course came out of an understanding and the host's statement that she didn't know a lot about Asian Americans. And that's what we frequently see when we're talking about bias, even in incidents that are much more serious, frankly, than the one that happened here. We see that people just have no understanding of the history or the experience of a particular group.
So, Dave, that's one case in California. Does it have wider implications around the world and for other companies? I mean, these sharing economy platforms are gradually coming up against all sorts of issues like this, aren't they?
Yes, well, I think one of the things that's made these platforms really popular, whether it's Airbnb or Uber or any number of these applications where you know who you're dealing with, is that discrimination can grow from that. And I think what we're going to see is similar rules being put in place, not just across the US, but across the rest of the world. And Kevin Kish did stress that the law they used it to do this isn't new. It's just the fact they've got closer tie with Airbnb. And so the precedent has been there for some time. It's just this ability for the company and the department to work together to solve that. And he said he'd like to see other states and indeed other countries pick up this lesson and take it to help solve this problem, as well as the other things that Airbnb is doing to try and stop racial discrimination on its platform.
Lots of companies in that area finding out that as their businesses mature, they have to take on more regulation and be a bit more careful about what their users do. Thank you very much, Dave. Now, professional sports, and particularly football of both the American and English varieties, are very lucrative businesses. But now one of the leading video games firms believes it has a chance to make esports, where audiences watch pro game players in action, into a money spinner to rival the NFL or the Premier League. Activision Blizzard is launching a league in which teams play Overwatch, a cartoon-like shooting game which is low on gore and designed to appeal to a wide audience. The first seven teams are reputed to have paid $20 million each to enter the league and get a share of revenues from future tournaments. Activision's chief executive, Bobby Kotick, told Leo Kellyan why he thought this could be the turning point for esports.
We have this incredible group today of 30 million really passionate fans, and that number is growing. The NFL last year generated $7 billion of broadcast rights and $1.5 billion of sponsorships and $1 billion of licensing and $3 billion of ticket sales against a fan base of 70 million people. Our fans play with more frequency. They're engaged year-round, not just in a season. It's a global fan base. It's growing at a very rapid rate. And so if you were to just take those 30 million people and you look at their desire to have spectator experiences based on professionally produced content, or their deep desire to want to be part of a social experience, and this is the thing about Overwatch I think is so unusual is our players get this tremendous sense of belonging from this play experience. And so enhancing that to local loyalty, where there's actually a physical venue that you can go and you can watch organized competition, those are the things that really can extend and expand and allow the franchise to be even more successful and recognize and reward our players.
One of the things you're doing, though, is chasing after the biggest of the big name consumer brands, when typically we've seen in other esport competitions the kind of people who provide sponsorship are really kind of from the gaming community. Why do you think those sponsors are going to want to be involved with Overwatch?
Well, if you look at traditional sport, the average age of the demographic keeps expanding. So if you want to reach 18 to 35-year-old males, and now with a greater frequency, even females, we have 11 female characters in Overwatch now. So if you want to reach 18 to 35-year-olds, you really need to be where they are. And they are playing games. They're especially playing competitive multiplayer games like Overwatch. The other thing that we offer uniquely is Overwatch is a very family-friendly game experience. It's a teen-rated game, so it's super colorful, super friendly. If you look at the geographical diversity of the maps or the ethnic and racial diversity of the characters, those are all things that we took into consideration in the construction of what we thought would be a globally appealing experience.
But if you look at a lot of the existing teams from who you all presumably want to talent spot, a lot of them are male-dominated. Is it important, do you think, to have a better mix of players within those teams? And does that mean either some kind of positive discrimination or even maybe considering an all-female league?
If you look at our total company customer base, more than half are women. People don't really recognize that of our player base, we have such a high percentage of female players. And I think in Overwatch, what we're seeing is that the play dynamic, the fact that there are 11 female characters, the fact that they are racially and ethnically diverse, that's starting to create a lot of enthusiasm and interest on the part of our female players. And we're continuing to see an increase in that player base. So not only is there not a need for a female-only league, we designed the game to be inclusive and to be play patterns that would be as comfortable for female players as they are for male players.
That's Bobby Kotick, chief executive of Activision Blizzard. Ben Skipper, our special guest here, video games journalist from IB Times. Put this into context. How far has esports got? Because for a lot of people, it will be a very alien concept at the moment.
It's been growing enormously over the last decade and a half. So now you have millions and millions and millions of people watching around the world. It's certainly big in Asia, but in North America and in Europe, you're seeing bigger and bigger competitions with enormous prize pools. Just this week, Dota 2 in the US for the international, its big tournament in the summer, has broken its own record for the largest ever esports prize pot, and that's $20.7 million.
And what are people doing? Are they sitting in stadiums mainly? Are they watching it on TV? They're watching it on channels like services like Twitch and YouTube?
primarily on streaming services like those, but they are drawing a bigger and bigger crowd in these arenas that are getting bigger and bigger all the time. So one such esport might draw 10 or 20,000 people.
And what's your view of this Overwatch idea? Is this the one that is going to take it onto a whole new level?
It's a very different idea. It's an ideal structure, this franchise model, to appeal to a wider audience that esports hasn't necessarily done so far. I think a big reason most people don't watch esports is because there's not a reason to support certain teams, and having these local teams based in cities creates that for people.
Jane Wakefield, my colleague, is sitting there. She's got a slightly furrowed brow. Earlier, you were saying to me you were questioning the validity of the term esports.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, I don't object to people playing these games, and I don't object to people watching these games if that's what they want to do. But why call it sport? I mean, I haven't got the dictionary definition of sport with me, but doesn't it involve physical exertion or something?
Well, snooker, I put to you, not much physical exertion.
Yeah, but at least you're standing up.
Ben, put Jane right here. You told me before you were an Arsenal supporter, for which, commiserations.
I'm glad you brought that up on air.
Yeah. Could you get as committed to, I don't know, an Overwatch team or another esports team as you are to your football team?
Theoretically, yes. I mean, I'm not going to play for Arsenal as much as I'm not going to play on these stages playing Overwatch. But if people want to fly their flag for a certain esports team, then why not?
We'll look forward to you starring in an Overwatch tournament in the future. You could be a big transfer target, I'm sure. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, the battle to be top dog in AI. First, though, let's have a quick look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Jane Wakefield. Jane, Australia, the latest country to say something must be done about encrypted messages which law enforcement can't see.
Yeah, so Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull wants WhatsApp, Facebook and other big tech firms to hand over the content of encrypted messages. And that's something that lots of governments around the world want in the light of the increased terror attack. But Mr. Turnbull has courted a deal of controversy with some of his assertions or lack of knowledge about encryption. So he was asked by journalists how the law he proposed would stop terrorists and criminals moving to encryption software not controlled by these big firms. And he replied that the laws of mathematics were very commendable, but that the laws of Australia would prevail.
That went down well on the internet, I'm sure.
Yes. And he also showed a bit of a lack of understanding about how encryption can actually be cracked, saying he didn't want a backdoor, but instead communication should be handed over, and I quote, in the usual way that applies in the offline world. So I think what we're seeing here is there's still a big gap between what politicians want and their grasp of the technical challenges that are faced in doing it.
And Google turns out to fund a lot of academic research. Why has that proved controversial this week?
So a US group called the Campaign for Accountability has identified more than 300 research papers that are directly or indirectly funded by the search giant, and they're all about public policies. And its claim is that it uses its wealth and power to influence policymakers. It said that a number of studies were spiked during periods when the firm was under scrutiny from regulators, and that some studies blurred the lines between academic research and paid advocacy. And Google's hit back at these assertions, claiming that the group itself doesn't name its own corporate funders and points out that one of them is Oracle, which it claims is running a lobbying campaign against it. And it also points out that it's got a long tradition of academic research and has always respected the independence and integrity of its researchers.
Another punch up between technology giants there. and a luxury phone maker whose mobiles used to sell for $10,000 or more has gone bust. What's gone wrong?
Well, I know that you love a diamond-encrusted mobile, Rory, but from now on you're going to have to find other ways to get it. Get your handset blinged up, because the luxury phone maker Virtu has collapsed. Its phones were not cheap, as you said. You know, they started at around the $8,000 mark. And one of its unique selling points was that it provided a bespoke concierge service so that you could book tickets for prestigious events and have 24-hour service for whatever you may want. But that doesn't seem to have been enough, and in recent years it's faced tough competition from other businesses that offer to customize your iPhone or Android device. So you could still get those diamonds, Rory, if you want them, but you just have to go a different route.
Ben, did you ever fancy a $10,000 phone? I mean, the trouble is it was edged out by other luxury, it wanted to be a luxury brand, but there were luxury brands, you know, iPhone, Samsung Galaxies and so on.
It's not really my cup of tea. I think my phone's like 2 or 3 years old at this point. I'm not really on the cutting edge.
Yeah, you need to join the Premier League of phone owners and get that concierge service and a bit of diamond encrustment. But it doesn't sell anymore. Now, we've talked a lot on this programme about artificial intelligence, the key technology of our age that seems to promise huge transformations in the way we live and work. There's something of an arms race going on amongst the tech giants to prove that they are ahead in this field. Google, with its DeepMind division, and IBM with Watson have made plenty of noise about their AI research. But this week, Microsoft held an event in London to stake its claim to thought leadership in artificial intelligence. I went along. We're at the top of a tower overlooking London, one of the centres of AI research, and Microsoft scientists have come from all around the world to show off their wares. We've seen an app called Seeing AI, which allows blind people to look at the world, get information back. It's looked at me and said, I'm a 52-year-old man looking happy. We've seen an instant translation service allowing you to do a PowerPoint presentation and then have it translated live into all sorts of languages, and a number of other applications that are out there building on what Microsoft says is 25 years of work in this field. It's really looking for the recognition that it feels others have had. I've been speaking to Steve Clayton about that record of research. He's Microsoft's chief storyteller.
Microsoft Research was set up about 25 years ago, and the first three groups actually that were part of Microsoft Research were focused around AI, speech, language, and vision, really sort of taking computers into a new era where computers can see, recognize, and understand the world in a similar way to humans can.
And how far down that road are you?
Yeah, there have been some real breakthroughs in the last 3 years around this whole field of machine learning, and in particular this field called deep neural networks. And what it is the combination of almost infinite computing power being available in the cloud, enormous amounts of data from all of these devices we have in our world, and a breakthrough set of algorithms that can really start to take all of that data and begin to understand and recognize it in much the same way that we do.
And do you feel you're actually getting to a stage where it's coming out of the labs into products that affect people's lives?
It absolutely is. Even a couple of years ago, a product like Skype Translator, which allows people to have a simultaneous conversation from one language into another, that's capable because of the benefits of AI. Or even more simple things, but you know, just useful things, like the ability to log on to my Windows PC using my face. That's because of AI being able to recognize me and detect me and allow me to log in.
The company's also been outlining what it calls its design principles for AI, reflecting some of those concerns about ethics and so on. And I've been speaking to Emma Williams, who's in charge of that project for Microsoft.
The heart of it is that the human is the hero, and we are creating AI technologies at Microsoft that amplify human ingenuity so that this can unlock a new era for human innovation and creativity. It's all about the human.
That sounds nice, but there are huge decisions to be made, aren't there? There's still difficult decisions. You design an algorithm, for instance, that decides whether people get insurance or not. You can build biases into that.
Well, Microsoft is taking an extremely principled approach to the way that we are building our products. We really encapsulate it as fate: fairness, accountability, transparency, and ethics. And we understand those concerns, and we are putting deep Microsoft research capabilities behind addressing those challenges and issues.
But isn't it naive to suggest that there aren't actually very difficult dilemmas, particularly for a commercial company? There's a lot of money to be made out here. How careful are you going to be before introducing some of these innovations which look fabulous but can have unintended consequences?
Again, I'd say is we are very aware of our corporate responsibility here. And in fact, to the degree that we have founded a partnership for AI, that we are reaching across the community to other large AI companies. It's called the Partnership for AI. We co-founded with Google, and we have 40 different large tech companies and nonprofit organizations collaborating with us on making deep, deep, thoughtful decisions around what is the right ethical stance in AI product development.
That's Emma Williams from Microsoft. Now let's get an outsider's view of this battle to dominate AI. Azim Azar writes a weekly newsletter, The Exponential View, which documents news about artificial intelligence.
I think a lot of people believe that AI is going to be as big as electricity to economies, industries, businesses and society. And there will be many winners. And Microsoft wants to be one of those winners. It probably feels that the likes of Google and IBM have snuck out ahead of it.
And what is it about what's happened in the last 5 years that has suddenly focused all of these giant companies on the need to be a leader in this field?
Well, about 5 years ago, we started to see some breakthroughs in what AI could do. It started to be able to identify objects in images or translate between human languages or transcribe spoken text at levels approaching to and now better than what we as humans can do. Once that milestone was passed, people realized we can actually practically apply AI and it doesn't have to be a toy that lives in the lab. AI, like many technology markets, is likely to be a winner-take-all game. And we've seen a few winners emerge in tech, like Google and like Facebook. And if AI follows the same pattern, particularly with its demand for lots of data, those who come in the first ranks will win all the rewards, and those who are in the second echelon will get nothing.
That's Azeem Azar. Jane Wakefield, you've written a lot about artificial intelligence. Mm. Let's face it, Microsoft has it's got a bit of a battle on its hands here, isn't it? Because other people are buying up all the top scientists.
Yeah, it's certainly not Microsoft you think of first when you think of AI. And in terms of the top scientists, yeah, we've seen people like Jeff Hinton go to Google. Jan LeCun is at Facebook. I'm not sure if Microsoft has any top name AI scientists. But that doesn't mean the stuff it's not doing in the lab isn't as good. But it lacks the PR in some way, doesn't it? You know, we've seen Google's DeepMind play these amazing games of Go, which has really captured people's imagination. In the past, IBM had its, what became Watson, play Jeopardy and beat two human players. So maybe, you know, Microsoft needs to sort of rethink.
It needs a stunt, is what you're saying.
It needs a bit of a stunt, I think, yeah.
Ben Skipper, you're a games journalist. Is this intersecting with your world, this sort of sudden huge advances in AI?
It is, yeah. And you're seeing video games play a part in AI research as well. Like just recently you had the AI behind driverless cars being taught in Grand Theft Auto 5. And you've got Minecraft being used to teach an AI assistant to anticipate the needs of the player.
And it will actually impact as well on the way games are developed, I suppose. We're often told we're living in a simulation anyway. We may find that the simulations get ever more real as artificial intelligence is fed into them.
Absolutely, yeah. You see AI in games getting better and better all the time and more convincing as well. And they don't run on set paths anymore. They can make decisions on their own.
Jane, briefly, we also heard Microsoft trying to stake its claim to be an ethical company in this area. They're all going to be saying that, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what we care about.
There is an image problem with AI, isn't there? It's associated with science fiction and, you know, takeovers. And so all of the companies are very keen to be saying that they are going to make sure that they don't let that happen.
Yeah, all of their products are going to be very human, telling us they're not going to replace us, they're going to augment us. We're out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Ben Skipper from IB Times UK. Thanks to Jane Wakefield. Read all of her stories and mine and so much more from the BBC Tech team at bbc.com/technology. Tell all of your friends about our podcast and join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.